This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. The entire Massachusetts delegation is criticizing the latest MBTA service cuts. In an open letter to MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak, the state's full slate of senators and representatives are asking for information on why the T is moving forward with service cuts to train, subway, bus lines, despite an infusion of federal assistance from the newly signed American Rescue Plan. Here to discuss that with us is Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch. Congressman Lynch, I know it's a busy day. Appreciate you making some time for Radio Boston.
No, good to be with you, Tiziana.
So just mentioned the letter from yesterday. On Monday, you also had some harsh words at a press conference for the MBTA. Why are you so deeply and personally engaged in this issue?
Well, these are our frontline workers, right? So they've been, in particular, there are 40, there were 40 conductors on the commuter rail who were told that they were going to be laid off or furloughed in the midst of this pandemic. So here they are, frontline workers. We're in the midst of trying to get the economy back on track. And we just gave the state another almost $1 billion on top of the billion plus that we gave them in the CARES Act. And while we are trying to help the governor open up the economy, they were cutting service to the very taxpayers who paid for the bailout of the MBTA, and they're laying off the very workers who have been doing heroic service in driving the trains and driving the buses. So I do want to say that this morning I did have a follow-up meeting with General Manager Poftak.
Okay.
After our earlier conversation yesterday that did not go well, they got back to us, and they have reconsidered their decision to furlough the 40 workers. So those 40 conductors, I'm happy to say, will not be laid off.
And those were Keolis workers. Excuse me. I just want to clarify, because this is news. You're talking about the Keolis workers from the commuter rail. Is that correct?
Right. I had met with them about a week ago. Yeah, so I met with the union heads of the 40 workers. Yeah, they were for Keolis, who has a contract with the MBTA to operate the commuter rail. So those 40 workers, as of my conversation with Mr. Poftak this morning, they relented, and they said they would not be laying off those 40 conductors, which is good. And so that part of the problem apparently has been solved. And they asked for an opportunity to review the service cuts as well to see if there was a way to bring those back as well. I think it may involve bringing additional employees onto the payroll. They discussed the need for training and other steps that might be necessary in order to bring that service back. So we're going to give them an opportunity to do that as well.
So I just want to clarify all this because news is moving quickly. So you spoke with General Manager Steve Poftak both yesterday and today. You were dissatisfied with yesterday's meeting. You spoke with him again today.
Yeah.
As a result, the furloughs of the Keolis employees has been undone. And you're hearing that they may actually roll back some of the service cuts as well?
That is correct. That's fair enough. Roll back some of the service cuts. Yeah. They did want an opportunity to review. So, having them stop the layoffs was good. And I thought I owed them an opportunity since they saw the rightness in that decision. I thought we should give them an opportunity to review their service requirements. And they are issuing a joint statement, my staff and Mr. Poftak's staff, just to memorialize the agreement that we had that would prevent the layoffs of the 40 workers and also moving forward. I'll try to get a copy of that letter to you when it's available.
Fantastic. Thank you. We'll be able to put it on our website at radioboston.org. Is there a timeline for when they'll get back to you on this reconsideration of service cuts or explicit next steps that you're intending to kind of hold the MBTA accountable to and follow up to these two meetings?
Sooner rather than later was the understanding in terms of their review of service cuts and trying to restore it. Again, they raised the issue of bringing people onto the payroll. During the pandemic, there's been a certain level of attrition. No layoffs, but there's been a certain level of attrition among MBTA and Keolis workers, largely due to people being close to retirement and then not wanting to obviously put their families at risk and just deciding to retire early. So apparently there's been a drop off in the workforce. And so now they believe in order to sustain some of these services, they may have to bring people onto the payroll, not back onto the payroll, but bring in new employees. And there's training that is necessary, especially with the pandemic ongoing. So that may take a bit of time. I'm not certain.
So this is helpful to hear, and it allows me to then ask you a couple of other sort of pick our heads up questions, Congressman. When we had talked to General Manager Poftak here on this show on Monday, we had played some of your criticism from Monday morning. He gave us a response that really emphasized the long-term risks to the T budget by decreased ridership. And so the stimulus money, the money from the American Rescue Plan, will help. But if ridership stays down year over year, what are your expectations for how the T should manage that revenue shortfall, given your concerns about service cuts? Or do you feel like this $1 billion that comes out of the American Rescue Plan should cover the T for a number of years?
Well, great question. Here's the key. This is all about timing. So we think that this pandemic is going to change transportation patterns in Massachusetts. It's going, all over the country, that's going to happen. So people are working from home. We're concerned about the demand for office space in Boston, but there's going to be a reconfiguration of our transportation patterns. What I objected to was that Mr. Poftak was basing his service cut decisions on the situation right now when people are hunkered down. We're just now getting the vaccines out. And so what I argued with him was that, look, it is better to maintain the services now. We just gave the state, the T $1 billion. Let's maintain the services now. After we figure out what that reconfiguration of transportation patterns might be, we can obviously direct services in response to demand. And I think that's the way we should do this. For instance, they were arguing that they wanted to cut ferry service to my constituents in Scituate and Hull and Hingham and Cohasset, Quincy and Weymouth, and they wanted to keep it going, keep the ferry service going in December, January, February, and then they wanted to curtail the service on the ferry May, June, and July, which didn't make sense to me. That's the busier season they were canceling out. So what I was asking them to do is to just keep the services in place. Let's measure demand when we feel like we're back to a somewhat more normal pattern of activity. They're expecting the end of the summer or early fall to be a good measuring point. And then at that point, there will have to be a reassessment of transportation needs in the Commonwealth and probably regionally. So I think that is a better time to look at the facts and base our transportation policy on real-time demand, not on what's going on right now, because this is an aberration right now that, ridership is down 92% or 94%. This is not the measurement you want to take in terms of planning long-term transportation demand.
So that then raises an interesting question, because we're in an aberration in pretty much every aspect of our economy, because this is a once in 100 years level of pandemic here in the United States. It feels to me as an observer that this relationship between the congressional delegation and the Baker administration in this case is a little unusual. Should we expect to see this kind of back and forth between members of the delegation and the Baker administration on other aspects of policy related to the money that's coming in from the American Rescue Plan? Could that be a part of our new normal as we all seek to recover here?
I think there might be certain aspects of that. I think that in a couple of contexts, one being this bill, because we fought very hard for specific provisions, you know, for schools and you know, we have a restaurant revitalization bill. We have a lot of money in there for daycare and other needs that have been exacerbated by the pandemic, and we're hoping that our priorities are in harmony with the governor's priorities, and I think they mostly are. You know, this is exceptional with the MBTA, where we're trying to put people back to work and they're laying off people. That's a clear dichotomy. However, in the upcoming transportation bill, for instance, there are what they used to call earmarks, but now they call local community priorities that will be inserted in the bill. And there might be differences there where our local towns and cities have asked us to make certain projects a priority in those local cities and towns. I'm hoping that the governor and the Secretary of Transportation, Secretary Pollock, are on the same page. I think they are. I invited them down about 18 months ago. They came down and we tried to make sure that the governor's priorities are the same as the members of the delegation, the congressional delegation, and they seem to be. They seem to be. There's a need to, you know, build two new bridges over the Cape Cod Canal that Mr. Keating has been extremely involved in, and also this idea of East-West Rail that Chairman Neal and Chairman McGovern have been interested in, and which actually would help Eastern Massachusetts a great deal in terms of the insane housing costs that we're seeing right yeah. now. So we think there is general harmony, but there might be instances where, you know, the member of Congress for a certain district may have different priorities than the governor might. But that hasn't come up yet.
Well, Massachusetts Congressman Stephen Lynch, I really appreciate, again, I know it's a busy day, appreciate you making the time, and I hope you will come back and join us again soon as we continue to sort of track our steps towards recovery.
Of course. Happy to do that, Tiziana. Good to be with you. Take care now.
Thanks. Thanks. You too. So listening there to that conversation was a friend of Radio Boston, Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation and a board member of the advocacy group Transit Matters. Jim, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back. That was a fun conversation.
I'm glad you thought on some news there. So what I'm looking for is your reaction to all the information we just heard from Congressman Lynch.
Well, it's good news to hear that there's apparently a commitment to stop laying people off and to take a hard look at the service cuts. And let's see, you know, the devil is always in the details here, but I think the congressman earlier this week stepped up to the plate. From my perspective, it's the kind of leadership I yearn for. By just calling this out and saying, you know, the federal government has given Massachusetts transit agencies, the T, a total of almost $2 billion, with the B, $2 billion in the past 2 years. And with $2 billion, the idea that we have to cut service or lay people off is not credible. It's just not credible. And so I'm glad that he was able to get this apparent victory, and I look forward to seeing it implemented.
You heard the congressman tell me that this is partly a question of timing, that he understands that ridership could be down for a long time, but that now it sounded to me that he was saying now when we're trying to recover is not the time. So could we, in your mind, see appropriate service cuts down the road?
No, in fact, I think the opposite. So for two reasons. One, we're in the process now of getting more and more people vaccinated. As people get vaccinated, their behavior patterns will change. They'll want to be more engaged in the normal course of business activity, including returning to work, maybe more flexibly, not 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, but maybe 3 days a week, 10 to four. But that is already beginning to happen. If you read what people are saying in the business community, that's what they're expecting. Harvard and MIT have both said everyone's back on campus in fall. That's a lot of people moving in and out of the city. We need a transit system, both commuter rail and subway and bus, that is already able to respond to them. In other words, the T's pattern, which is to say we're going to wait until riders tell us when they want to ride and then we'll change. By the time they wait, it's too late. You've got to prepare now. And by preparing now, what I've been calling for is changing service plans. We need, for example, commuter rail to run every 30 minutes all day long, so that that person who wants to commute flexibly to work or to other destinations is able to do that reliably on a regional rail system that's responding to real life post-COVID mobility needs.
Jim, I appreciate the analysis. Just in a sentence,
yes.
Were you surprised to see this kind of back and forth between our delegation and the Baker administration this week?
Yes, because it doesn't happen very often. But I think it was a demonstration that the congressional delegation saw this as a flashpoint, as a point of crisis. They are working very hard and getting some criticism, you know, across the country, the Democrats are, for using reconciliation to pass this bill. And if I was in the Congress and I had just provided the MBTA with almost $2 billion of funding, I'd have greater expectations than service cuts and layoffs. So I think what we saw was the congressman responding to that flashpoint. And I think, thankfully, as he's reported, what we're about to see is the T being responsive to it. And being responsive to him means being responsive yep. to everyone.
Jim Aloisi, former Massachusetts Secretary of Transportation, thanks for joining us. Helpful to have your analysis.
Thanks.
Listeners, WBUR News reached out to the MBTA for confirmation of Representative Lynch's comments. The MBTA confirmed that Keolis will not go forward with the planned furloughs for 40 employees. About reconsidering service cuts, the MBTA said, quote, with ridership remaining at less than a third of pre-pandemic levels, the MBTA continues to monitor work and travel patterns and match service to ridership with increasing service for the most transit-critical communities. As it plans ahead for the long-term budget impacts of the pandemic, the T will responsibly spend federal stimulus dollars and monitor ridership and make adjustments as necessary, end quote. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. On this show, when we speak to Mendon author Michael Togas, it is usually about his latest best-selling book of heroism and rescue at sea, From the Finest Hours, which was made into a movie by Disney, 10 Hours Until Dawn off the coast of Salem in the blizzard of 78, or So Close to Home, about surviving a German U-boat attack. In other words, many of his 30-plus books are full of adventure, danger, heroism, sacrifice. And that is also the case with his latest just out, but the focus this time is much closer to home, his life and his family. Togas' new memoir is The Waters Between Us, and we spoke with him recently. He began by telling us why he turned the searchlight from sea heroes to his real-life hero, his father.
My dad was one of those larger-than-life figures. As soon as somebody saw him, they'd be smiling, and he would just light up a room. And I'd been taking notes for this book, you know, going way back in my 20s about some of the misadventures, like when I almost died in that $15 raft I bought going down a river in April. I had different sources to draw on besides just the memories. I had a diary from when I was 12 years old, starting to put it together. And after he passed away, then you can go back even further and some of those events from your really young years come back.
So the book has a subtitle, A Boy, A Father, Outdoor Misadventures and the Healing Power of Nature. And these misadventures, you just talked about a story you tell of going down some water you should not have been in a $15 raft with a friend. And there are so many times where I found myself thinking, this guy's instinct for self-preservation was underdeveloped. Are you that same guy, or did telling these stories bring a piece of you back as well? And if you are that same guy, how are you still alive?
There's a lot of luck. When you're impulsive, as I was, there's luck involved. Going down a raging river in April when there's snow on the ground in northern Vermont is not a good idea. As I put the book together, I realized it's just one thing after another that was so impulsive, like trying to get the great picture of the moose. I figured, well, I'll throw a rock its way.
You throw a rock at the backside of a moose at close range.
Oh, my God. And I can remember, you know, shouting to my brother, run for your life. And as I'm running, I'm thinking, my father's going to kill me because I was entrusted with the care of my little brother. You know, I'm a lot older now, but I'm still that same person. As my father used to say, why do you always have to break the rules? Why do you have to push the limits? And I'd be like, I don't know. And I'm that same person.
So what do you think you learned from being that guy? And what can young people who read this book learn from it, especially in the midst of a pandemic when risk just takes on a whole other kind of calculus?
Well, one, don't be as impulsive. But on the positive side of the ledger, I never had anybody expertizing. Like, my father was not a big outdoorsman. And so he wasn't saying, you know, when I was a boy, the fish were this big, or here's how you attack a mountain when you're going to climb it. So everything I did was by trial and error. And looking back, I think in many ways that's a good thing because it taught me independence, but it also taught me, no matter what the situation, I'll somehow figure it out, because he wasn't there for those kind of things.
He wasn't there until he was.
You know what? I said those exact words last night to a friend who was asking me about the book. I said, you know, he never came to my wrestling matches, my soccer games, but a little later, when I was struggling and dropped out of college, he had my back, and he really surprised me. I did not expect that.
You know, I got an understanding through across your family and through the emergence of your father in the book. He's kind of a quiet background character till close to the end. That his sense was, and your sense was, that crisis is when it really matters. And he was there for all of you in crisis. What have you learned from that about what it means to show up?
You know, the beauty of the way he reacted, and we'll talk a little bit about the big tragedy in the family, yeah, was he chose how to respond. That's what I learned from him. He could have become bitter, angry, withdrawn, but he said, no, I'm going to do this and life is going to go on. And he was still that fun-loving guy, despite the new burdens that were put upon him. And that's what he taught me.
So let's talk about that burden, the crisis. There's a bombshell in maybe the last fifth of the book. And let's just have you read that bombshell for our listeners. It's right at the start of chapter 17.
Okay. The fun days of college came to a screeching halt in February 1976. That's when I got the phone call. I was in my dorm room when a friend knocked on my door and told me my mom was on the payphone. I had a bad feeling from the get-go because my parents never called me, knowing I was impossible to reach and that I would call them once a month. I can still see that payphone in the hallway of the dorm and remember how I stood there stock still, listening to my mother. She told me my sister Lynn and her newlywed husband had been in a car accident. She said it was bad. Then there was silence. Finally, I asked how bad, and she said, Lynn's in a coma. I could hear my mother softly crying. I asked where my father was, and she said he was by Lynn's side. I better come home, I finally said. My mother caught her breath and said, yes, but I should finish up my classes for the week and get home on the weekend. She said, the most important thing I could do was pray. And pray I did.
That's author Michael Togas reading from his new memoir, The Waters Between Us. Of course, what stands out there to me is you ask where your father is, and she says he's by Lynn's side, which, of course, that's where he then was permanently. Talk about what happened next and the sacrifices that your father made.
Well, that accident left Lynn paralyzed and severely brain damaged. And after months in a rehab center, there were still tubes and everything else attached to her. And my father just said, we're taking her home. And the doctor said, no, you won't be able to do this. And he said, teach us what we have to do. We're taking her home. And for the next 30 some odd years, he and my mother took care of her at home. And it's hard to describe. I get a little emotional even now. But it was a 24/7 job. It's not like you could get a good night's sleep. You were up during the night helping her. And every once in a blue moon, I'd step in so they could get a night away. And just in a 24-hour period, I thought I'd lose my mind. It was so difficult to do. And I just marveled that they did this for so many years. And my father would say, it's an honor to take care of Lynn. It's no burden at all. But it was just this amazing devotion.
And that's what you meant when you said earlier about the choices that he made, right?
Exactly. You know, this was the biggie, and he decided, we're going to do this. We're going to keep Lynn as part of the family. We'd get her in a wheelchair. I'd often help him. And even though she couldn't eat with us, she'd be at the dinner table with us. So, and again, he never became bitter. You know, he was such a social animal. He just said to all his friends, you come to me. And they would come to the house all the time. I think it drove my mother nuts. But he never changed. He'd be laughing with them at the house while he was taking care of Lynn. And it was just jaw-dropping to me to see how he pulled it all off.
You know, your mom did hold it all together, right? I'm sure it did drive her nuts some of the time. I wonder as a mother how it wouldn't. Sometimes I pictured her as I was reading your story as a woman sort of standing firmly in the center of a hurricane. Tell us a little bit about her and how she fits in the story you're now telling yourself about yourself.
She was very reserved and very quiet, but every once in a blue moon, she'd surprise me. And one example I give in The Waters Between Us is I've organized senior skip day at high school. And by this time, I've turned my life around in terms of grades at school. Prior to then, I had broken the school record for detention. Because I organized a senior skip day, the principal was going to expel me because every senior skipped school. And I had to tell my mother. I didn't dare tell my father. And she goes, I'm heading down there. And I said, where? She goes, to that principal. And I couldn't believe it because this was a woman who didn't say peep. And somehow she got me out of that jam. And so underneath her, kind of what I earlier thought was kind of a timid person, she had this rock solid strength, and she was there with my father during Lynn's accident and deserves as much credit as him.
So I think about comparing your mother and your father, who were real people, but also for me, characters, right? Because I'm reading this memoir and all of the daring sea rescuers and sea rescuers in the other books of yours that I've read. Where do you put your mom and dad in the pantheon of these heroes that you write about?
The heroes I've written about the past, it's usually one and done. In other words, The Finest Hours, Bernie Weber does that rescue, but it happened in one evening. Ernie Hazard in Fatal Forecast, he survives 3 days in the North Atlantic. You know, he's off the charts of survivability. But you have to also acknowledge these people that get up day in and day out and do something extraordinary and don't want any credit, don't want any attention. So I put what my mom and dad did right at the top of that list, because to sustain it and not crack or not become bitter, and withdrawn is a real feat.
You know, it's almost second nature at this point, a year into this pandemic, to just ask what the lessons for us are. But it doesn't have to be second nature here, because I believe there are so many lessons in this memoir that have something to say about the moment that we're in. Is there one that you would draw out for us a year into this pandemic?
It's that endurance of going, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to make the best out of this situation. I'm not going to let it affect, and I'm talking as my father's mind, the rest of my family, because it wasn't like, as he's helping Lenny's giving short change to the three boys. The same with this pandemic. A couple times during it, I'd feel myself getting depressed in isolation, and I'd go, screw that, make yourself productive. And I'd do whatever the task was, and then I'd go out and take a long walk. And I would think of my father during this going, this would have been, he used to have a little expression when I talk about a problem, he'd pretend there'd be a piece of lint on his shoulder and he'd just flick it off. And he'd go, that's what I think about that. That's small potatoes. He probably would not be happy with this book, because he would say to me, I don't want you writing about me. There's plenty of other people that have done things just like your mom and I. But I felt, how could I leave this out of my story?
New York Times bestselling author Michael Togas. His new memoir is The Waters Between Us. As of this coming Monday, Massachusetts officially enters phase 4 of its reopening, what Governor Baker originally described as what would be our new normal. That means that for the first time since March 8th, 2020, fans will be allowed inside the TD Garden. We figure what better time therefore. There he is, because we're going to check. I don't even have to introduce you anymore, Chris. Everyone knows that's Chris Siderick for Check the Score. A little bit excited,
hey,
Chris?
Oh, I can't tell you how excited I am. The prospect of being able to get back to a place where it can be responsible and safe to have fans in the stands is beyond exhilarating.
So what do we want to know from listeners?
Well, so I'm really curious how anxious people are to go back to sporting events. Are folks champing at the bit here to get back into the stands? Or are folks going to be a little slower to come back and kind of see how things go as more and more folks get vaccinated? And they can jump in, as always, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. They're going to start with a 12% capacity. So I think tickets may be hard to come by, at least initially. But we'll see kind of as the year goes on how and when that gets expanded.
That's right. So if you are a Bruins fan, a Celtics fan, a Sox fan, Patriots, are you going back to the stands? Call us and tell us what you think. So, Chris, with that prospect of watching Boston teams in the stands on the horizon, there is a ton of news about our Boston teams. Let's hit through it. Lightning round. Where do you want to start?
Yeah, I mean, there are so many options here to start. We could talk about LeBron James being a part owner of the Red Sox, the Patriots throwing an absolute mountain of money around in free agency. You've got the Bruins, a game tonight in Buffalo against the Sabres, which has been affected by COVID. They had to call off their morning skate. As of 1:30, they've tweeted that as of now, the game will go on as scheduled, but we'll have to see. I actually, though, would really love to start with the Celtics. That's the team that we left off talking about last time we did a Check the Score.
All right. So you told us going into the All-Star break, we were talking about how badly Boston needed to rally behind a team. And you said, okay, so that means the Celtics have to find a winning streak over the last four games before the break. They did. They found a winning streak before the All-Star break.
Yeah, and that's about all they found. They are 1-3 since the All-Star break. I was really hopeful that if they went into the break hot, they'd be able to carry that momentum through, but clearly that has not been the case. So since the All-Star break, they've lost to the Brooklyn Nets and the Utah Jazz, which you can understand a little bit. Those are pretty good teams. But last night, a really bad loss to the Cleveland Cavaliers. They just started slow, looked sluggish. They were down 21 at one point, and they did rally and fight back. They got to within 4 points a couple of times in the fourth quarter. And then really the final nail in the coffin here, with about 2 minutes left in the fourth, Jaylen Brown had a chance to cut the lead to three and missed.
Brown catch and shoot, rebounded by Garland. Garland up ahead with Okoro, goes there. Oh, Okoro throws it down
just an absolute dagger. And the Celtics just looked like they couldn't close out. They looked tired. They had kind of bad body language throughout this game, slumped shoulders. And really, the thing that we've been talking about all year with this team so far, where is that killer instinct? Where is the heart? Where are the guys who are going to pick each other up and rally and say, no, we refuse to lose this game? So far, they just haven't shown that.
So, so interesting. After, you know, 20 years of always having a team where the answer to all those questions was, yeah, absolutely. Here we are, right? We're turning to the Celtics and they can't do it for us. To that point, Chris, and, you know, there was like all set up to this, but you shared some tape with me earlier today that is so mind-boggling that I just want you to talk about it.
Yeah, this is pretty great. So Danny Ainge, the Celtics GM, has a regular appearance on the Sports Hub, and I just had to pull what he said about this team coming off of last night's loss. So this is from earlier this morning.
We've struggled to close out games, and we've struggled with consistency. And I think that, you know, you hear me talk a lot about resolve. It seems like we don't have a lot of characteristics of a really good team, for sure.
So that, as you said, Tiziana, is staggering, yeah.
Yeah, and I just want to point out, listen, if you're one of those listeners who doesn't necessarily follow sports, surely you can hear that it would not be normal to hear a coach in the middle of a season or an owner in the middle of a season talking about a team like that. So what does that mean for what the Celtics do now, Chris?
It's really interesting. I was talking to our engineer, Marquise, earlier, and he said half the people are stunned that Danny Ainge would say this, and half the people are probably like, well, what took you so long? What have you been watching? Because this team has really struggled with this specifically, really for the last couple of years. They've got all the young talent you could want. They've got two of the best young players in the lead. In the league, and they just haven't been able to put it together. They haven't seemed to be able to find that chemistry where if one guy makes a mistake, the other guys can pick him up and hold each other accountable on the floor. It's all about hustle and heart in basketball. It's really so much is about effort. You can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't have the effort and if you don't function as a team, it's going to be so much harder to be successful. And, you know, you look back at this team, the expectations were so high. They were in the Eastern Conference Finals last year. It looked set up to make a deep run again. And I go back to what Jason Tatum said after they got bounced from the Eastern Conference Finals last year. He was asked if the team needed to be mentally tougher. He said no. And I was just so taken aback by that because it seems pretty clear to everyone watching, this team needs to get tougher all around and really maximize the talent of the individual players.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. 800-423-8255 to tell us whether you are going to get back in the stands for your favorite Boston sports team. We've got Sean on the line. Sean, I think you're in your car in Canton. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
So what's your plan?
I'm a teacher during the day, but I've worked at the TD Garden for the last 15 years as well. And we don't have any idea when or if we're coming back sometime soon. But I don't know how particularly safe I would feel with having thousands of extra interactions during the year. It's tough enough during the school year, so I'm partially vaccinated. I've had my first shot, but I don't know just long-term how safe that would be with that many people kind of coming through the same building.
Sean, is there anything that would make you feel sure that you were safe?
I think it would have to be another year, maybe when there's just more of that herd immunity where more people are vaccinated. I just don't know. I don't know how safe I would feel with just masks and social precautions.
Sean, I really appreciate that call. I think, Chris, that puts in perspective the moment that we are in. I mean, Sean, clearly working at TD Garden, plus I'm assuming, given, Sean, you worked at TD Garden, that you're a sports fan. Gillette Stadium for the Patriots, that's an outdoor stadium. Fenway is an outdoor stadium. TD Garden, which we have two teams that play there, indoor stadium. Are we going to see maybe people go outdoors first, or do you think there's a two-year tail before people really feel safe cheering on their teams in person?
I mean, I think it's going to be really interesting to watch. This is uncharted territory, obviously. I think anybody who tells you they know exactly how this is going to go is kind of making it up because we've never seen anything like this. As I said, we're starting with 12% capacity is what they're allowed to bring into the building. And they the TD Garden has had to submit this huge plan in terms of how they're going to try to make sure that everyone's following safety protocol, Masks are required in the stands at all times unless you're actively eating or drinking. They're going to allow folks to order concessions on their phones to try to eliminate waiting in lines. At the end of the game, if anybody's been at a game in the Garden, you know those crowded stairwells leaving. They're going to attempt to have people leave the building similarly to the way you would leave an airplane, kind of like row by row. So there's a whole host of possible solutions that have been put into place, protections. We'll have to see how it actually works on the ground. But I think folks, for the most part, are cautiously optimistic that if we do this responsibly, we can do it safely.
All right, so kind of watching our clock. Why don't you pick one other of the Boston teams you want to check in on right now?
All right, so I hate to skip the Bruins because I love trying to convince you to be a Bruins fan. But I want to move to
Hope springs eternal.
Because I do think what we have seen from the Patriots this past week has been staggering. I've been a Patriots fan all my life. I've never seen anything like it. They were by far the heaviest hitters in the beginnings of the NFL free agency. They've signed a ton of players, multiple tight ends, nose tackle, linebackers, receivers. They re-signed Cam Newton. That's a separate issue. We need about 20 minutes to fully get into that one. But I think it's clear that this team is aggressively approaching this season. And reloading with talent up and down the roster. Not to mention they're going to get guys back like Dante Hightower, who held out last year because of COVID concerns. To put it in perspective for you, they spent $81 million in the first few hours of NFL free agency this year. They spent $51 million over the last three off seasons combined. So that just gives you a sense of exactly how aggressive this team is right now.
Okay, so I hadn't realized that stat, and it makes me want to ask you, lots of people don't like teams that go out and buy victories. This sounds like the Pats are.
It's also not a very successful model. Yeah, I mean, if you look at history, teams that spend big in free agency generally don't do that well because you're bidding against everybody else, so you end up paying guys more than what they're worth, and therefore you don't have enough money to fill in around them at the other positions. But there's a few factors here, I think, and not the least of which, Bill Belichick, we all know, is an evil genius, right? He can read the market better than anybody. So for the first time since 2011 this year, there was a lower salary cap, which means teams across the league, in many cases, had to shed players before they could worry about signing new players. So they had to basically get under the salary cap. Yeah.
Right. So just to clarify, salary cap is total amount you can pay the body of your players, correct?
Exactly. Last year was a little over $190 million. This year it's down around $180 million. So there are less teams bidding for these free agents. And also, the salary cap is expected to go back up next year when some new TV deals are announced. And so contracts that you sign right now, you probably have to pay a fair amount more for those same contracts next year. So Bill Belichick always thinking about value. I do think it is a factor that Tom Brady went out and won the Super Bowl his first year without the Patriots, not to mention the fact that the Patriots were pretty much a laughingstock last year. Even though they ended up 7-9, they at times looked horrible. And you know that had to just eat away at him.
So what are you going to be watching for as this team sort of gets together? Obviously, the season is a few months away, but people start watching now.
Yeah, the big question for me is quarterback. They re-signed Cam Newton. There were a lot of things working against him last year, and I like Cam as a player and as a person. He seems to be a pretty upstanding guy in the clubhouse. In terms of on the field, he did not look good last year. Now, to be fair, they didn't have the full offseason workouts. He was recovering from a shoulder surgery, so that could be a factor. And he did end up going under the COVID list with COVID about 4 or 5 weeks into the year. So there were a lot of things kind of working against him. I hope they have a plan A, though. I hope Cam is expected to be the backup, and they're either going to draft a young quarterback high in the draft or potentially sign or trade for somebody here that could fill that role, because a quarterback is really one of the most important positions in all of sports. You need that guy to set the tone and to get the ball to these wide receivers and tight ends that you've signed. Last year, Cam couldn't get the ball 10 yards down the field in the air. So we'll have to see kind of what moves they make there.
All right, we'll keep watching that. Now, in our remaining time, I want to take some time to recognize a couple of local Boston sports legends that we lost this week. I know you said you wanted to say something about Boston Marathon icon Dick Hoyt, so I'm going to let you take us out of the show with that. I'll take a moment first, then, to note the death of marvelous Marvin Hagler. He died in New Hampshire Saturday at age 66. I think it's really hard for some people to understand how big a sport boxing was in the 1980s, if you weren't sort of a sport age then. That was when Hagler was a great middleweight fighter. He came from Brockton, where he moved as a teenager, and he had to make a name for himself under the shadow of another Brockton legend, Rocky Marciano. He did it. He fought some legendary fights, and while fighting, to make a name for himself. So much so that literally he fought to make a name for himself. He changed his name to Marvelous. I watched actually a lot of boxing as a kid. That might surprise you, but I did. And he quit basically after a fight when I saw as a kid with Sugar Ray Leonard. It ended in a split decision, which means the judges picked the winner and they picked Leonard, which was a shock. To Marvelous Marvin Hagler. And I remember for me, it was one of the first times in my young life that I realized that sports could actually be subjective, that winning and losing wasn't always just sort of a matter of how many points you scored. He was a fighter in his community, well-respected in the area. And I just want to note, Marvelous Marvin Hagler, again, died in New Hampshire over the weekend at age 66.
It's so interesting. And he was one of those guys. There's kind of two types of fighters in the boxing world. There's the media darlings, and then there's the guys that have to kind of scrap and claw for everything they get. And he was definitely the latter. And I think that's why so many folks kind of connected and identified with him. And as you mentioned, I do want to also recognize the passing of Dick Hoyt, who passed away yesterday at the age of 80. He was part of Team Hoyt. He pushed his son, Rick, who had cerebral palsy, in a special chair. And they would run every Boston Marathon. Up until 2014 was their last race. And actually yesterday, after the news of his passing, I went back and rewatched the finish of 2014 when Meb Keflezighi became the first American to win since 1983, the year after the marathon bombing. And I just was so moved by that because, you know, Team Hoyt represented everything that makes the Boston Marathon so incredibly special. You know, the triumph of individuals over adversity and the community coming together to support and cheer that. I don't know that anybody ever got a bigger ovation than Team Hoyt when they would go by the crowd literally the whole way down the 26.2 miles. I just wanted to play a little bit of sound from an interview yesterday. Dick's son Russell spoke with WBR's Jack Lepiarz, and you have to hear this. Russell talking about how his father and brother got into running. Basically, Rick brought a flyer home from a fundraising race for a family whose son at Rick's high school had dove into a swimming pool and broke his neck. So Russell says his dad's only running a mile or two a week at that point, but Rick really wanted him and his dad to enter this race, and so they did. And I'll let Rick tell the rest of the story.
Everybody expected him to go, you know, the end of the street, turn around and come back, but they ran the entire 5 miles. And their claim to fame, they came in second to last, but not last, never been last in a race that they've entered. And when Rick crossed the finish line, there's a picture of him with this smile. And my dad says it is the biggest smile he's ever seen in his life. And when Rick went home that night, he got on his computer and he spelled out, "Dad, when we're running, I don't even feel like I'm handicapped anymore."
So that's Russell, Dick's son, telling that story. And I'm sure there's going to be an incredible funeral service, and I'm sure there'll be something at the Boston Marathon, which right now is scheduled for October 11th with a smaller field. But we will keep an eye on that as the year moves along.
What a great way to end. Chris, thanks for checking the score with us. Radio Boston's Chris Siderick.
Thanks for having me. Always fun.
Great to have you. And that, listeners, is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for the Radio Boston Week in Review.